As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
There are decades when nothing happens, and there are weeks when decades happen. Not my words, but the words of Vladimir Lenin, who died in 1924, who might well have been describing Tottenham Hotspur in April 2021. You're listening to the View from the Lane podcast. My name is Jack Pitbrook. I'm joined, as always, by James Moore. This is our second and hopefully final podcast in what I think has been one of the most dramatic weeks in the modern history of Tottenham Hotspur. Since the Everton game on Friday night, they have signed up to a coup against the fabric of world football, sacked their manager, appointed Ryan Mason as interim head coach, withdrawn from the Super League in humiliating circumstances, beaten Southampton 2-1 at home amid fan protests, and are now trying to save their season, win the League Cup at Wembley, get back into Europe, and find a new manager. The Dulux dog was only 1 week ago. James, you must be absolutely emotionally exhausted. I know I am.
I'm emotionally exhausted just from that intro, let alone all that stuff actually happening. Yes, it's been an absolutely ludicrous week to support Tottenham Hotspur. I genuinely forgotten about that stupid dog. I think at the time I tweeted it, it was kind of ranked in the top 20 most humiliating things that happened to the club, and actually now it's probably slipped out of that list by a margin because...
30,
Yeah, it has been absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah, it's that's what we're going to try on this podcast, is to just pick through some of the bigger things that have happened the last week. I know we spoke briefly on Monday afternoon after Tottenham had announced the departure of Mourinho, which now amazingly feels like a footnote in this week somehow. It kind of feels like, you know, a minor event that's happened amidst everything else. Maybe Tottenham wanted it that way, I don't know. Let's start off with what, you know, the unambiguously good news of the week, which is that last night at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, Spurs play Southampton. I was there. Spurs obviously won 2-1. And James, it was, given the circumstances, I thought they did really well.
Yeah, I mean, it was really good to see Spurs grow into a game. I can't remember the last time I watched Tottenham play and they improved as the game wore on. I mean, I don't know if you can think of one, but generally the theme has been over the season, really, they've started well and then kind of regressed. I guess those ones early in the season.
Burnley away, maybe?
Yeah, mate, I mean, they scored late, but I don't think they played well at all, really, did they? I mean, they certainly didn't play as well as they did in the second half yesterday. I mean, Southampton away, I guess you would say. I think they actually, from memory, they started okay in the first sort of 10-15, then fell out of the game, then equalised just before half-time, and obviously were fantastic in the second half in that game. But I can't think there have been too many times this season where they play better in the second half than in the first half, so... I think as a fan, I mean, in a footballing sense, it probably doesn't really make massive difference. But I think as a fan, just in terms of like clinging to positives from a performance and from a game, it's much better for the good bit to be at the end than the start, right?
Yeah, I'd completely agree with that. They were pretty bad in the first half. There's no getting past it. They were kind of sloppy. They were sort of slow on the ball. Saints just look much fitter and quicker and stronger than them. You know, Saints often do that. They've got, because of the way they play, they'll be brilliant for half of a game or 60 minutes of a game. And then obviously Danny Ings went off and Saints lost a bit of that bite. But the second half, you know, it was good to see Spurs trying to pass the ball, defending higher up the pitch. You know, it wasn't the case that they had Dyer and Alderweireld were not sat on the penalty spot hacking the ball away for the whole second half, which is something we've got very used to. Spurs passed the ball well. I thought Lo Celso grew into the game. I thought Ndombele wasn't brilliant in the first half at all, really, but he grew into the game. And by the end, they were playing some really good stuff. Like that, the goal that was the Son goal that was disallowed by VAR, which I think was kind. You can kind of see why it was disallowed because Lucas was in the goalkeeper's sight line. That was such a good move. The way they played through the whole pitch, that was really, really good football. I love watching that, James. I'm sure you did too.
There were definitely a few kind of positive signs in the second half of things that I don't think we've seen loads of in the last couple of months. Like kind of chasing the ball towards the end of the game when, you know, they were 2-1 up in those last few minutes, you know, 6 minutes of injury time in the last couple of minutes of the 90. And they're chasing the ball in the Southampton half, trying to win it back higher up the pitch, trying to keep Southampton, you know, penned into their own kind of defensive third. And that is definitely, definitely not what you would have seen in previous matches. As you say, you would have seen the ball hoiked into the Tottenham box and, you know, Dyrald or Vireld, whoever else, dropping in, trying to hack it out. And, you know, when you play like that, you're obviously inviting pressure and you're inviting opportunities for the opposition to get an equaliser one way or another. So, yeah, it was good to see Spurs play on the front foot even when they were in front as well. And I know they weren't in front for that much of the game, so it was only a sort of, what, 8-minute window or whatever. But, I mean, I think it's pretty telling that even in the 95th minute, Spurs were, you know, there were Spurs players herring around after Southampton players in possession in their defensive third when I'm sure they're a bit knackered as well. So, I think it'd be foolhardy to say it was an incredible performance by any metric, but there were a lot of encouraging signs, I'd say.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you could see the players looked like they were enjoying themselves a bit more. Certainly at the end, they looked incredibly relieved and happy to have won that game, which was, you know, their first league win in a while. And on an individual level, I think it's so good and important to see Bale reintegrate into the team. He obviously scored a fantastic goal for the equaliser. He didn't really get in the game much in the first half, to be honest, but his goal was brilliant. And, you know, I did see a lot of Spurs fans saying, well, why didn't we play this guy all season?
Yeah, that was like the main emotion from, you know, what I saw on Twitter and from talking to friends as well after the game and in the last kind of half hour after that goal. People are just annoyed, really, that they've been denied like the opportunity to see that more often than they have. And you know, you think about it, he basically played in that 1 month of the season when Spurs won more or less every game. You know, obviously they played better in the autumn, as we've said many times, but in that kind of spell, what was it, sort of February, I guess it was, he made such a big difference. And I talked a lot about the positivity among the fans as much as anything else. And look, I mean, that is a less tangible thing when there's no fans in the stadium. But, you know, in terms of your enjoyment of supporting your football club, like to see a fantastic player who is a loved player as well, you know, on the basis of what he's done in his first spell, to actually see him given opportunities to play and do what he does, which is what he did yesterday, and create incredible moments. That's kind of all you can ask, really. It's what you want to see. And, you know, that the Spurs team this season has been so... it's felt so lacking in moments, really. I mean, there are players there who can provide them. Obviously, you know, Kane and Son we've talked about to death, and Ndombele has had a few.
Yeah.
Lo Celso, maybe one or two, Lamela, whoever. But Bale is a player who will provide, like, a moment a game. And actually, to be honest, there were two yesterday. There was the goal, and there was that back heel to Son in the second half as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that like little moment of ingenuity that, you know, and that easily could have been a goal. You know, Son took a touch and got that shot away, and if that doesn't get blocked, I think that's probably going in the bottom corner. So... yeah, I don't think Bale has ever really been a player who like dominates matches. I mean, you know, the San Siro in 2010, that's a long time ago. And even then, I mean, the two of those goals were in injury time, weren't they? It's not like he was kind of running that game.
Yeah.
It is baffling. I mean, I think we all have a vague idea of what's happened there and the agendas that are at play. But I think what is going to be the most frustrating thing come the end of the season is that Spurs are going to finish like 2 points off the Champions League. And it's going to feel like... if this had all happened a month ago, or the managerial stuff, I mean, not all the other nonsense. If this had all happened a month ago, maybe they would have found like the other 2 or 3 points at the end of the season may make a massive difference. Because just look at it, you look at the fixtures that are left, you look at how far ahead the teams ahead are. You know, Leicester are now going to be slightly distracted by the cup final. West Ham have had a little bit of a wobble.
Yeah.
You know, conceded a lot of goals in the last few games, West Ham. I think 10 in the last 4. Chelsea, loads of games, have had a couple of little wobbles against teams you'd expect them to beat in the last couple of weeks. Obviously, you know, FA Cup, Champions League. Liverpool dropped points this week as well. You kind of look at it and think, well, none of those teams are going to win every game. And the Spurs can come in and, you know, they've still got Aston Villa at home, Wolves at home, Sheffield United at home. Who are the other two? Leeds away, is it Leicester away? Is that it? Five?
I think so, yeah.
But obviously, Leeds and Leicester are very tough games, but Leeds is certainly a winnable one. And Leicester, last game of the season, you know, they may have had top four by then, and obviously they're in the FA Cup final, so they may be distracted by that. So you can look at those fixtures and think there is a possibility that Spurs could get a decent number of points on the board there between now and the end if they're driven and motivated and happy. But I still think it might just see them fall that little bit short, and I think that's going to be incredibly frustrating if it does pan out that way.
Yeah, I wouldn't be at all surprised. I think it's, like you say, James, getting into fourth, I fear, will just be beyond them, although I am now more optimistic that they will be able to finish in a position which gets them Europa League football for next season, which is, you know, it's not the best, but it's better than nothing. But Spurs do have the possibility of a really very successful Ryan Mason interim era, in the sense that on Sunday they've got the Wembley League Cup final, which is, again, like the Mourinho sacking, does feel slightly like it's been dwarfed a bit by events off the pitch. But it's a really, I'm really excited to see how this game goes. Like, you know, I've got to be honest, I'm not optimistic about Tottenham's chances because, you know, they've got a manager managing his second game in senior football and he will only have been in the job 6 days. That said, you know, anything can happen in a final. Spurs obviously have, you know, Spurs are not, this isn't like City against Wigan in 2013, which is the game that obviously City lost. Spurs have got some brilliant individual players who can make a difference, as we saw last night, and hopefully they'll have Harry Kane back. And of course, City, I think City will probably play a team like the one that lost to Chelsea in the FA Cup semi-final last Saturday. They've obviously got PSG in the Champions League a few days later, assuming that game goes ahead, which I think it probably will do, but we'll probably have to wait for confirmation. So yeah, James, Spurs underdogs, but kind of positive underdogs, I guess.
The dial hasn't shifted that much to kind of swing Spurs too much closer to Man City. I'd say maybe a couple of notches up on the scale. I think I am mixing metaphors there, aren't I?
Notches up on the scale, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. But yeah, I think that's the feeling about that game now. It's just totally different, isn't it? You know, you talked a bit about like the looks on players' faces towards the end of the game last night, and it felt like, you know, the celebration of a Son penalty. Pretty much every player was there in the huddle. You know, Aurier was doing his thing and going absolutely mad. So the sense of relief, I think, that a lot of those players will have felt, again, you had to kind of separate the managerial thing and the Super League thing, which I guess will also hang over the players this week. I'm slightly more confident than I was, say, a week ago. And I think the possibility of Bale playing in that game and, again, providing a moment.
Yeah.
I think just increases Spurs' chances that tiny bit, because I think with Mourinho in charge, and again, you know, he did beat Manchester City twice in his time as Tottenham manager, so you can't disregard that one of those times about game, of course. But I think we know how they would have played, and I suspect it would have been similar to the setup at Everton. I think that was kind of the thinking there, wasn't it, from what people were saying?
Yeah, maybe.
And, you know, pack the team with defenders, a couple of defensive midfielders, try and hack balls up to Harry Kane and Son and see what happens. I mean, look, it has won Spurs games, but quite a long time ago now. And I think the defensive solidity has continued, as we've established. So, I don't think that would have been a particularly enjoyable experience for Spurs fans. And I think, you know, their strength is in attack, and that's the way they should take the game to Manchester City. And I think they'll do that now.
Yeah, I can definitely see Spurs scoring. You know, City are not unstoppable at the back. John Stones obviously going to be suspended, having got sent off in the game at Villa Park last night, which means Laporte will come in, who's obviously a very good player, but not City's first choice. So I can definitely see that Spurs team scoring. I just worry that if Spurs do score, City will then just also score. City will be able to cut through them. But
obviously, like, it's a final, and we know City want to win this competition. They've won it loads of times in the last few years. Was it 4 of the last 5 or whatever? But how seriously do you think they'll take it now? But, you know, had a bit of a wobble in the league. I know they won last night, but I don't know, massively convincing. United are, what, like 7 points behind now? So, you know, it's obviously City's to lose, but they do still need to win, three matches, say.
Three matches, yeah.
And obviously, we think they're going to have Champions League games next week, or a Champions League game next week. How strong a side do you think City will play? Do you think they'll rotate again? Because that team that played against Chelsea, it all seemed a bit odd to me. It didn't quite work.
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if it is like that team. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe Zach Steffen will play in goal again. Fernandinho will come back in. Maybe, I mean, Zinchenko actually played last night. Maybe, it's strange, you know, maybe Jesus, maybe Sterling. So not bad players.
Jesus, sorry, can we at least say Jesus so it doesn't sound weird?
No, actually, my stance on this now is calling Gabriel Jesus. Jesus is a word that exists in English. It's fine to, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I just don't like doing the Jesus thing. It just weirds me out. Anyway, Harry Kane, obviously Harry Kane picked
the
up
real Jesus. Again,
this is the kind of, yeah. This, again, another story that would be a huge story in any other week, but it's now just a footnote. So Harry Kane picked up a ankle injury on Friday when Spurs played at Everton. He was scanned on Saturday. I gather that scan was not very bad. It's not a bad ankle injury. It's not like one of these 6 to 8 week ones which he's had in the past. That said, he's obviously missed training at the start of this week. He wasn't involved yesterday. He was there at the ground watching it in the stands. I think they're just taking it day by day. You know, it's a case of, you know, seeing, can he train on Thursday? Can he train on Friday? I think, you know, obviously I think they'd do anything possible to get him on the pitch. But I guess we just have to wait and see on that. I think in terms of changes, James, if he's fit, I'd bring Kane in for Lucas, who played as number 9 last night. Didn't think he was especially good. Beyond that, I don't know. Would you make any other change? Would you bring in Winks for Ndombele? Would you bring in... I'm not sure I'd bring in Lamella.
It's a tough one, isn't it? Because that midfield three that played last night, and that was the three that we were kind of calling for at the start of the season that we were desperate to see. And then when we have seen it, and not just last night, but it's not really worked, has it? There's something about that sort of Ndombele, Lo Celso combination that, I don't want to say they're luxury players, but they kind of are, aren't they? They're not players who, sort of similar to what I was saying about Bale, they're not players who like run a game, who dictate the tempo, who have their foot on the ball loads. They're kind of players who drift in and out and come up with the odd moment of brilliance. Yeah. Do something that looks amazing that maybe isn't necessarily the most productive way to use the football.
Yeah,
be great fun to watch, but maybe not exactly help the team control the football match.
Yeah, quite.
And you know, you want players who do things like that because they're going to be able to unlock the door when you're playing against like a packed defence or whatever. But whether or not Spurs can accommodate two players like that in midfield, I guess, is a slightly different question. And if I was going to drop one, I would probably say Lo Celso just purely because. And Ndombele, I think, has had a better season. It's slightly higher ceiling in terms of performance.
Yeah.
Whether or not you then bring in Winks, that's a difficult one. I mean, Sissoko, I'd say historically, he's had some pretty good games against Manchester City.
Yeah.
I don't know if that necessarily means you want to put him in there.
Maybe that is the pragmatic decision, putting Sissoko in. I don't know whether that's what Mason will do or not.
But, no.
I do agree with you that the NHL midfield hasn't really delivered. And I just think neither Lo Celso nor Ndombele is quite complete or defensive enough to cover for the other one.
Yeah.
I think you really need one of those two to be able to do a lot more defensive work. And it hasn't quite worked yet. I think, in my mind, I think Ndombele is your kind of maverick, and then Lo Celso is the guy who does everything. But Lo Celso just hasn't been quite there in terms of fitness and performance this season.
I guess I think with Ndombele, and this sort of does apply to Lo Celso as well, like, they're not really consistently creative enough to play as a number 10.
Yeah.
But also, as you say, they're not maybe positionally disciplined enough or kind of diligent enough when it comes to covering to play like as the 8 or whatever in midfield with Højbjerg. So, where do you play them?
The other thing to mention about Sunday is there's going to be fans. There's going to be, I think, 2,000 Tottenham fans there, 2,000 City fans, and then a few thousand fans from the local area, I think, and NHS workers, which is really cool. Like, obviously, Spurs haven't played in front of fans since November, I think.
December would have been, I think.
December, yeah. So that'll be good. It'll be much more like real football. I'm going to the game. I'm really, really excited about it. James, did you apply for a ticket?
Yeah, I applied for a ticket and didn't get one, so... I'm incredibly bitter about that.
Well, it's going to be interesting. I'm sorry for you. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, you enjoy yourself, mate. Don't worry about it.
I'm not rubbing it in. I'm genuinely not rubbing it in. It's going to be interesting to see what the atmosphere's like. You know, I'm sure the fans will be very positively behind Mason and the team, despite, you know, everything that's gone on this week. I actually think Mason is a very good kind of, for Spurs fans, it's great to have someone who they can be so, like, unambiguously and positively supportive of. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure they'll be very, very pro Mason, and it should be a nice atmosphere.
Yeah, that will be interesting. I mean, I guess the thing is, when you've got, because I think it'll be like 2,000 Spurs fans, right?
Yeah.
And I think some of them are sort of whatever they're called, executive members or whatever, basically corporate people. So I, you know, when you have that number of people sort of rattling around one massive chunk of Wembley, I think it's probably quite difficult to get any sort of vociferous targeted abuse at any members of the board. So I don't imagine, unless something happens outside the ground beforehand, I don't know if there'll be some kind of coordinated thing between the two sets of fans as well. That wouldn't necessarily surprise me. That's not me saying that I've heard something, by the way.
Yeah.
But yeah, it will be. I think it's the first game with two sets of fans properly. I mean, I know in that FA Cup semi-final last week, there were kind of, I think there were sort of some fans of the two teams, but officially it was like NHS and local sort of Brent residents, right? But this is the first game with like a proper allocation of fans for two teams since, was it that Villa Leicester game in the Premier League in like March? And I suppose the Liverpool Champions League one, that Atletico Madrid game that everyone always talks about as being like a sort of super spreader event. So yeah, it'll be quite weird to kind of have that. I mean, again, you know, it's quite hard to kind of get that sort of back and forth going with so few people in a massive stadium, but it will be quite interesting to see if there's any sort of jovial stick.
Yeah, it's going to be good. I'm really looking forward to it.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
The last time we did a podcast was Monday afternoon, a few hours after Tottenham had announced the sacking of Jose Mourinho. It's obviously, you know, it's been a crazy week, but I think it's worth coming back a little bit just to look back on that, James, really. It will still go down as one of the biggest decisions that Daniel Levy's ever had to make, that dismissal. And if you can detach it a bit from Super League and everything else, which you will come to at the end of this podcast, James, how are you feeling about it? Do you think it was the right decision now the dust has settled a bit?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, it does seem, you know, and you've written a fantastic piece, if you don't mind me saying, about, with the help of some of our colleagues, we should say, by the way, I don't want you to take all the credit, about what went wrong for Mourinho. And you can talk about some of the details in that, because, you know, I'm sure you'd like to pick yourself up a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it sounds like things weren't exactly, on the whole, going smoothly on the training ground for the last couple of months, let's say. And you can kind of see that on the pitch, or you could kind of see that on the pitch. And I think even on Wednesday night, you could see in the first half there was still that kind of tension and that nervousness that I think it seemed like kind of ebbed away through the game, and actually they kind of found a bit more confidence and a bit more positivity as the performance kind of progressively improved. We were incredibly positive about Jose Mourinho when things are going well, and then we were quite negative when things are going badly, which I know some people will think is fickle, which I suppose is fair enough. But I will speak as a fan rather than a journalist for a second. Like, I really did not enjoy those last couple of months. It felt incredibly frustrating watching the team play consistently in that kind of regressive, defensive, negative way. Watching Tottenham was an ordeal. And, you know, you get people traditionally will kind of buy into that style of football when the team is getting results. And, you know, there have been teams who have obviously done that, including Mourinho teams, particularly at Inter. I think their football wasn't always great. I mean, I know they had some very good attacking players, but there were a lot of matches like that as well. But once those results fall away, and you can tell the players are miserable and hating it and would rather be anywhere else.
Yeah.
I think it's almost, I know you say it's a difficult decision for Daniel Levy, but I think it probably should have been quite an easy one, really.
Yeah, I think that's all fair enough. I think we can tell that things were heading very clearly in the wrong direction ever since Christmas. That was true of results and performances. And just the negative atmosphere that is really the side effect, the byproduct of how Mourinho manages. You know, it's all about disruption and confrontation and provocation and all these methods. And, you know, they have been very, very successful. And he is, you know, he has been a real master psychologist and master tactician when it comes to getting the best out of players. But, you know, I mean, we said it so many times, but it remains true. He just struggles to get the best out of modern players. And I think the story of his time at Tottenham is that, yeah, you know, a handful of players did like him and a handful of players did play very well for him. We've seen, you know, some social media tributes paid to Mourinho by Lucas and Kane and Son, for example, you know, some of the guys who did really well, but a lot of the players just weren't performing for him. And I know people say the players have to take responsibility, and I get that, but ultimately the manager was paid to get the players to play well, and Mourinho wasn't getting the players to play well. You know, we wrote in our story, it wasn't just that the players didn't like the tactics, which I thought a lot of the time I thought were negative, but they didn't like the training sessions, the constant focus on how do we win this game or that game, or how do we beat this team or stop that team, rather than, you know, what sort of football do we want to play? How can we dominate games? Another detail that we include in the piece is that his number two, João Sacramento, was very unpopular with the players, which I suppose is the risk that you take when you get a fairly unproven coach in his early 30s and give him such a big job. So I think that was a factor as well. And the other factor, I think, is just Mourinho's constant criticism of the players in public, which, I, again, you know, tactically this exists to get the players to play well. But in practice, I think it just has the effect of looking like the manager is blaming the players when everything goes wrong. And that happened, you know, almost every week at the start of this calendar year. And obviously, Mourinho was told not to do it by the club. Obviously, he continued to do that. And then by the end, we found Mourinho saying, oh, you know, I can't say what I want. I wish I could, but I can't. Because he knew that he wasn't meant to. But I think with that, you kind of knew the writing was on the wall, really, because he was acting so constrained by this situation. So, yeah, it's all over now. It was very dramatic and interesting and exciting 17 months. I think I can totally understand why Tottenham fans didn't enjoy it. Personally, I thought it was in some parts interesting, but then also other parts did feel quite repetitive, not least especially having covered him when he was back at Chelsea 2013-2015. And yeah, I guess I hope that, I'm sure James does as well, that Tottenham can, you know, draw a line under this and move forward. You'll need to subscribe to The Athletic to read that piece on Jose Mourinho's departure. If you're not already a subscriber, you can sign up now with a 40% discount for £3.99 a month. Just go to theathletic.com/SpursPod. That's theathletic.com/SpursPod. But the biggest story really this week, even bigger than Harry Kane's injury or Mourinho sacking or Ryan Mason's appointment or the League Cup final, has been Tottenham joining the Super League and then pulling out of it 2 days later, which is just is this the biggest story in sport history? I don't know. Maybe it is. You know, it's kind of an existential threat to the organisation of the running of the game and an attempt to, you know, pull the biggest teams out of the existing competitions. It's just unprecedented. And yeah, it's obviously upset an awful lot of people, James. And, you know, there were lots of Spurs fans yesterday with Enoch out, Levy out, banners, which are probably, I mean, look, there weren't lots, but there wasn't nobody either. And I imagine it's probably the biggest anti-Enoch protest since Tottenham tried to move to Stratford 10 years ago.
Yeah, I would imagine so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, also, look, you've got to factor in the fact that, obviously, one, pandemic, two, the game kicked off at 6 o'clock, so people were probably mostly still working, and three, they'd already pulled out of the thing the day before or the night before. So yeah. I think if it hadn't been for that combination of things, there probably would have been quite a few more people there.
I assume that they speak for a lot of Tottenham fans, even if they're not calling for Enoch to go, they're certainly very upset by Tottenham joining the Super League.
Yeah, I mean, I've not seen or spoken to a Spurs fan who has said they were pro Super League, even though Spurs being involved in that is perhaps quite a generous offering.
Yeah,
in a footballing sense. The thing that amazes me most about the whole thing, and this isn't a Spurs specific thing, is that they just weren't at all prepared for any kind of backlash, and they had no sort of prepared statements for people finding out about it, people being pissed off about it. You know, they announce a thing at 11:30 on a Sunday night, you know, 1:30 in the morning in a lot of the countries where the other teams play.
Yeah.
And that tells you so much about these people and the way they think that everyone else is just going to kind of fall into line, or that it doesn't even matter what people think. And the fact that, you know, even players haven't been consulted on this, or managers. You know, if you're the owners of Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp is your manager, like, he is so central to the success of that football club as a football club and as a business entity, as a brand, that you can't, like, make a decision like that and not ever consult with someone like that. I mean, Spurs obviously don't have that situation. If Pochettino was still the manager, and, you know, you would maybe say the same thing. But, you know, players as well seemingly just were completely caught out by it. And these sort of 6 or 12 men, or I suppose groups of men, at these 12 clubs, I'm just completely staggered. I mean, I know you shouldn't be, because, you know, people that have that much money are generally dickheads. But I'm just completely staggered that they thought they would get away with it, because they had no, like, they had no plan. You know, they've supposedly been plotting this for a prolonged period. It's not just like they've come up with it overnight. And they've just, like, not been prepared for any kind of questioning on it. None of these people have been willing to come out and openly talk about it. Now, all we've heard from Daniel Levy on it is that one sentence in that, you know, mealy-mouthed apology that we got 24 hours later, or 48 hours later. I just don't really understand how they thought they were going to get away with it. If they've given up that quickly, I mean, I can see how you think you're going to get away with it if you just plough on and just do it. But they've given up so easily, relatively speaking. Like, I mean, what I can't understand, did they not expect people to object to it?
Yeah, I think they could never have expected the amount of fan protest or the political reaction from the UK government. But it, to me, that just shows how much they were winging it.
I disagree with that. Of course they could. No, sorry,
they didn't expect it.
Oh, right, sorry.
But that's their fault, because they didn't plan it. They were winging it from day one, which just shows how kind of shambolic and amateurish it is. You know, the whole thing is just, it's just a complete shambles. And as a football fan, I have to say, I got more and more angry about it as Monday and Tuesday went on. Like, what gives them the right to do this? Just because you happen to own the biggest clubs at that particular point of time doesn't mean that you have the right to destroy the way that football's played and organised.
The thing that's really annoyed me with regards to Levy in all of this is that he's completely disregarded, like, the journey that he has been on with the football club. And there are kind of parallels with the Mourinho thing, actually, him appointing Mourinho. So he appointed Mourinho, like, the superstar Hollywood coach, big name, you know, generally a succeeder with, like, a big budget, you know, you get into Porto, fine, whatever. But he's generally a guy who's been able to go to a club, spend loads of money, get the players he wants, put together a really good team, win titles, fall out of people, leave. Obviously, he couldn't do that at Tottenham because he didn't have the budget, so it didn't work. What has worked for Levy has been bringing in, like, a more diligent coach who's had a longer-term vision, you know, wants to work with players, improve players on an individual basis, and then create a better team with a good ethos, you know, everyone pulling in the same direction and not being loads of, like, bickering and whatever, everyone on the same page. Clearly, Levy disregarded that and then went in the other direction and it didn't work, and then hopefully, you know, he'll swing back slightly towards a coach rather than a manager, which is what Spurs need, a team like Spurs need. And the parallel with the Super League thing is that Spurs haven't kind of been an established mega club in the same way that Madrid or Barcelona, Manchester United, even Liverpool, Arsenal are or were or have been. They've built their way up in a way more legitimate way than any of those other teams, or certainly in modern terms, certainly than like Man City or Chelsea. If you look at, you know, they've, with the greatest of respect, effectively bought their way into that over the course of the last decade, 15 years, right?
Yeah.
By spending a load of money on players. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the moral issues surrounding all of that now, but the way Spurs have got into that position is by developing players, like slowly spending and investing, building the stadium, you know, growing the club on a gradual basis over sort of a similar period of time, really. And got into a Champions League final eventually in 2019, which is an incredible achievement. Only one of those other 12 clubs has been in a Champions League final more recently than Spurs. Think about that. And he's completely disregarded that journey in helping create the Super League that's going to stop things like that happening. It's absolutely insane that someone like him, of all people, would like want to work like that.
Another way of looking at it, and this is not to defend Levy or Super League at all, is that over the course of 20 years of Enoch owning Tottenham, it's all been about building the brand of the club, building the value of the club, And, you know, how better to build the value of the club than to get it into this Super League? If the Super League were to work, you know, it's guaranteed revenues, it's controlled costs. It, you know, Spurs are not in the Champions League this year. They're probably not going to be in the Champions League next year. If the Super League had happened, then Spurs would be playing Real Madrid and Juventus every week. And, you know, in that sense, it would have really been the culmination of the training ground, the stadium, the Amazon, Mourinho, Gareth Bale, Alex Morgan, all that stuff in the last few years, which has been about growing the brand of the club to a point at which Spurs' valuation would be a lot. So I guess I do understand the business side thinking, but I just think it's, you know, morally unjustifiable, basically, to
which is unsporting, isn't it? It's business.
Yeah,
it's
to destroy sport business like this,
head and shoulders above sport by a long distance.
And I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised by Guardiola's comments. Not just him, but lots of people. You know, UEFA, Seferin, players, Luke Shaw, Ander Herrera, Bruno Fernandes, and everything. But what I really liked about it is the fact that fans of the teams involved came out so strongly against it. I was worried on Sunday night that some fans would be saying, oh, why shouldn't we go and do this? Why shouldn't we go and play in the Super League? We're going to win the Super League, that sort of thing. But there wasn't any of that at all.
Yeah.
None of that at all. I was really pleased with how, you know, whether it's Chelsea, City, Tottenham, whoever, the fans said, no, this is wrong for football. It's wrong for our club, but more importantly, it's wrong for football. And even though our clubs are the richest at the moment, we still have an interest in the fabric of football. I was so touched by that Chelsea fan with the placard saying, we want our cold, wet, rainy nights at Stoke City.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that is an important thing that I think fans of other clubs probably should remember. More than anything else, it's the fans of those six clubs that have sort of made the difference. I mean, obviously, like the interventions by, you know, you talked about Guardiola and I mentioned Klopp and those players as well. Obviously, that was important. I'm sure that the threat of sanctions, I'm sure, made quite a big difference too. But I think, you know, had there been buy-in from fans, if it had been universally approved by the fans of those 12 clubs, then I think that would be enough justification for them to push on. But clearly,
yeah,
didn't happen.
Completely. I completely agree. Like I saw a tweet the other night saying, oh, the fans of the big six have been pretty quiet about this. I thought it was complete bollocks. The fans of the big six have been really good about this. They've spoken up for themselves and for the interest of the game. And they've been able to say, you know, they haven't just seen it through the lens of club rivalry and club partisanship.
Whoever that person was needs to look at any tweet made by any of those six clubs between that announcement and them pulling out, because every single one of those tweets from all six of those clubs will have been like inundated with replies from fans of that club saying, like, hashtag whatever it was, you know, destroy European Super League or whatever it was. That is absolute nonsense.
Yeah, and I think Danny Baker.
Okay, fine. I've been really impressed by that, I've got to say. And I was worried, and I was more worried about Spurs just because I didn't want to be embarrassed by our fans.
But it
was great. The reaction to it was really good. And like, you know, like I was saying before, Spurs probably had more to gain there than any of those other clubs in a sporting sense, well, in a sort of quasi-sporting sense and financially. And I was delighted that the response was as vociferous as it was.
Yeah, it's actually left me with quite a sort of warm and positive feeling, really, in the sense that, look, obviously football has huge structural problems which are going to be very difficult to sort out. And obviously, you know, football remains, you know, the most powerful people in football remain the big clubs. But on Sunday night, I didn't think fans could stop this, and then they did. And I hope that this shows that it's not, you know, clubs cannot always have their way. And football is bigger than them. You know, football is bigger than what John Henry and Joel Glazer and Abu Dhabi and everyone else thinks, and Florentino Perez. You know, Florentino Perez is not bigger than football.
I mean, obviously, you know, the reality is they'll still try and move towards this, but it'll be just a way more gradual process than they've tried to implement here.
So, hopefully that will be a small glimpse of light in what's been a pretty difficult week for everyone, really.
That and Ryan Mason.
That and Ryan Mason. And then, of course, there's Sunday to look forward to at Wembley, which hopefully will be a very an unambiguously positive occasion, whatever the result. I think that's probably all we've got time for on this week's podcast. I felt like we've tried to cram in as much as we can. Thank you very much, James and producer Tom. Thank you to everyone who's reached out, especially to people with questions we didn't answer. We have had actually some brilliant questions in the last few weeks, which we'll probably never get around to. So thank you for taking the time to write in. We'll be back probably at our normal time next week. We'll record on Monday, the day after the final, where we'll look back at Wembley. We'll see what happens. Hopefully, there will be no attempts to destroy the organisation of football next week. And hopefully, no Tottenham manager will be sacked next week. And then, you know, our lives will hopefully get a little bit more normal. But let's wait and see.
The Athletic.